I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is Spy Talk. We got a terrific guest today, Larry Pfeiffer, a former senior director of the White House Situation Room, is here to talk to us about House of Dynamite, the nuclear war thriller that's been getting rave reviews, over-the-top reviews everywhere. But first, of course, we have a few items from our space in the world and national security and intelligence to discuss. Venezuela is one of them. Of course, there's a lot going on in Israel, Gaza. Trump has now announced that he's going to meet with Putin. My line is that if he'll solve two wars to get rid of Epstein, it's fine with me. Anyway, first up today, though, is Venezuela. It was reported yesterday that Trump confirmed the administration has issued a finding to conduct a covert war against Venezuela. This is what I call an overt covert war. So what do you make of that, Mike?
Well, I love it. This is a covert finding, and it's publicly announced by the president of the United States. Doesn't that defeat the purpose of being covert to begin with?
I would think so. We're not sneaking up on them.
I think in one of the papers today, this was described as unusual for a president to announce a covert finding. I'm not aware of another case of that happening.
Well, we did have the overt covert war in Afghanistan when we were covertly aiding the Mujahideen against the Soviet Red Army in Afghanistan.
Was that publicly announced by Ronald Reagan?
No, the president didn't confirm it.
Right. I think that's the difference.
Just everybody knew what was going on.
Wait, I think you guys are missing the point.
Okay.
We do it so often.
Not for the first time.
Well, let me just say that the way I see this was I was not surprised by this overt statement saying something that would really be about a clandestine activity, because I think the mantra of this administration is saying the quiet part out loud. And so much of what we would expect to be not said, we plan this, is being said out loud. That's part of what is frightening. That's part of what is so groundbreaking. And that's part of what is so, you know, such a change factor in the environment we're living in. And this is just another example.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to deploy covert action inside another country. And we're telling you what we're going to do because we're going to do whatever we want to do. And we're going to tell you about it. And I think it's a game changer and whatever. Yeah.
Well, look, I mean, it's certainly saber rattling, which our president does like to do, whether he intends to follow through or not. I mean, in this case, there are some, you know, although Trump has publicly announced that he's done this, what the nature of the finding is and what the CIA is authorized to do is quite unclear. The New York Times presented it as potentially lethal action. The Washington mm-hmm. Post described it in a more, you know, modified way, mm-hmm. said it could be psychological disruptions intended to destabilize the regime, but not necessarily shooting people. So we don't know. It would be a good question for our intelligence committees to find out. But sure. Given the state of oversight these days, I'm not sure we're going to get there.
And us being spy talk, let's talk a little bit about what psychological warfare is all about. There is a blueprint going back to 1954 in Guatemala in which the CIA generated rumors that a big army was marching on General Arbenz, and he believed it. They made enough noise and moved enough people around that he thought, my gosh, I am about to be overthrown and murdered, so I'll
But that was a full-scale coup, didn't we?
I think that's what these guys are talking about with Venezuela.
Yeah.
It is true that in all of that, you know, getting Maduro out of power has been, you know, one of the chief aims that keeps being repeated over and over, whether it's the attacks on the seas, whether it's this new finding, whatever it is. That's a consistent statement that's being made over and over again.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with Ukraine, Russia. One thing that people might have missed over the many months of kind of Trump dilly-dallying on Ukraine is that we are still supplying significant intelligence to the Ukrainians for their deep strikes into Russia, and that's very important. So beneath all the coddling, you might say, of Putin, that's still going on. The next item up on the agenda is apparently Tomahawk missiles, which can strike deep into Russia. So that's on the agenda. You had something about the FBI that was on your mind this week, Karen?
Yeah. I mean, Mark Warner, a Democrat from Virginia, has been collecting personnel data, which sort of has presented the FBI as really turning way more of its agents towards immigration raids, et cetera, immigration work than we had known before. And so what Warner has disclosed to the press is that it's 23% of the overall force, but it's 45% of the major offices, the 25 major offices in field offices in the United States. And so we're talking about thousands and thousands of agents who have been taken away from things from cybercrime to counterintelligence to terrorism, all of these and more, and put them onto immigration duty. And there are so many things that are disconcerting about this. One is what's going to happen to those offices and those official duties and the security and safety that comes with that. I mean,
they can't be happy.
Second of all, what does it mean to be able to redirect an agency within the Department of Justice, I might add, which already has so many issues in terms of redeployments, firings, et cetera, and people who have left? What does it really mean here? And that the last time we saw a reorganization at the FBI of this magnitude was after 9/11. Right, to deal with counterterrorism. But that was done in a very different way in terms of thinking through the structures, thinking through what it would mean in terms of numbers, et cetera, et cetera. This just sort of happened across the board.
To state the obvious, the political risk for Trump and his administration here is enormous, because if there is some terrorist attack or some massive cyber attack or something that threatens the safety and security of the country, there's going to be questions about where was the FBI, where was the Justice Department, where were intelligence professionals to stop it, right? Or to pick it up and act on it. And, you know, if there aren't good answers and it turns out that the people who should have been doing that are off, you know, arresting, migrants in Chicago, I think there will be political hell to pay.
Meanwhile, one wonders exactly what the FBI is going to be doing in terms of defining these groups. The Trump administration is seemingly going to define opposition groups, protesters and so on, as terrorists. You know, we have a history of the FBI defining political groups and opposition groups as terrorists. That was back in the 1960s and early 70s, defining the Black Panthers as terrorists, anti-war groups and so on. They went after break-ins, buggings, the campaign against Martin Luther King Jr. So we have a nasty history to it. I'm not sure a lot of rank-and-file FBI agents want to really go back to that part of their history.
Yeah, the way this administration sees it is that they define who's a terrorist. And part of that is the fact that we don't define terrorism in the law. Another part of, you know, specifically, another part of that is that for good reasons, the country decided not to put together a domestic terrorist list like we have for foreign terrorists. And in a way, it's left open. This will anybody, which which, by the way, a list would have done, that it just seems to be this massively expansive category that anybody can be thrown into. And this has been a problem for this entire century, I have to say, where it just has expanded more and more and more and allowed more and more activities both at home and abroad. And we're just seeing another iteration of it.
And as some experts have pointed out, the usual procedure is that we publicly name the terrorist groups that we are targeting. And in this case, the Trump administration seems to be taking the position it's not going to name anybody. So again, this is more secrecy.
They've named Antifa, only Antifa isn't an organization. So right. It does,
whoops. You know. So also there are rumblings that the Army may be involved in so-called counterterrorism work. There's a bad history there, too. The Army intelligence got involved in domestic spying back in the 1960s and 70s, and there's not a good ending to this. So it's not great.
All right. Well, look, I mean, these are definitely issues to be concerned about. But I've got to say, the discussion we're about to have is more terrifying than all of this. So I think we shouldn't bury the lead and get right to our guest, Larry Pfeiffer, on this unbelievably gripping new movie, A House of Dynamite.
For sure. Again, he was a senior director of the White House Situation Room, which is at front and center of this movie, The House of Dynamite. So he's going to be able to reflect. We interviewed him on Wednesday. He's going to reflect on any differences between reality and the movie and offer some really good insights into the psychology of people at work on this in this emergency situation where a missile is heading toward the U.S. So without further ado, let's bring on Larry Pfeiffer. Larry Pfeiffer, welcome to Spy Talk. As a former senior director of the White House Situation Room, you were a key advisor to the film The House of Dynamite, which I just saw in a movie theater last night, and it was harrowing. The first question, of course, is how accurate was it?
Well, you know, Kathryn Bigelow as a director, anyone who's seen her previous movies like Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, she is all about gritty realism. And so she consults with experts and brings experts into the movie making process to ensure that it is as real as possible. Now, that being said, it's a movie. It's not a documentary. So there's, you know, some license taken here and there to make the movie flow better, the storyline flow better. You know, there might be some conflation of roles just to make it a little simpler to carry the action forward. Overall, what I'm telling people is this is probably the closest the average moviegoer will ever get to being inside any of those rooms, be it the Situation Room, the Stratcom Command Center, a missile base up in Greeley, Alaska. It was a pretty darn close approximation to what that's really like.
So just for listeners who might not be familiar with this, no, the White House Situation Room isn't exactly one room. It's a warren of rooms in the basement of the White House, and it is a hub or spoke of communications between the White House, all you officials in the Situation Room, STRATCOM, Strategic Missile Command, Bomber Command, and so on, and this missile base, which is portrayed in the movie, right?
Right. The White House Situation Room is often referred to as the nerve center of the White House. It is where they monitor world events, they collect information, and they strive to get it to the president and his senior advisors as timely as possible so they can act on it as quickly as possible. So that's the goal.
So the movie portrays an unknown ICBM propelled over the top of the Earth, heading toward the U.S. They don't know where it's from, and they go into action and trying to find out where it's from and try to intercept it.
Correct. Right. This missile launch happens. They don't know where it came from exactly. It's flying over the Pacific. And over the course of just the first few minutes of the movie, they come to the quick realization that this sucker is not just popping over into the Sea of Japan. It's actually heading to the continental United States. And it's how the professionals, the policymakers, and the decision makers have to deal with that in a very, very, very short span of time.
Yeah.
Larry, let's focus on that, because I think that, first of all, the movie is absolutely riveting and keeps you on the edge of your seat for the entire time.
Almost unbearable attention. Oh, my God.
But I think most people looking at it are going to have, or at least I have, two big questions when I'm watching it. First of all, in the movie, this is a sea-launched intercontinental ballistic missile, we ultimately learn, from North Korea.
I'm not sure that's ever confirmed. I think it's what they believe.
It's one of the guesses.
And our and number one, our satellites miss the launch, which really kind of startled me to see. And then number two, our much touted missile defense system fails. It does not intercept the missile. So on those two sort of threshold mind-blowing issues, give us your sense of how accurate that scenario is, how plausible that scenario is.
So on the first point, they reference the DSP satellites, which are satellites that pick up infrared signatures of missile launches around the globe, or heck, it could be a big fire. It could be a big explosion. It's one of our first alerts for any missile launch around the world. I personally have never known it to fail. You know, you see a hot spot on the globe, you know that's where it's coming from. In this case,
that's good to know.
Yes, it is actually somewhat reassuring. In this scenario, what they posit is that they did not pick it up, and it raises the question as to whether there's been perhaps some compromise, some cyber attack, some assault or compromise on the DSP system writ large. At the end of the day, most of the professionals in there say that's a problem for after action reports. We have to focus on, are we going to be able to stop this thing?
A quick question on that. In the movie, the satellites fail to detect the launch. And when they do detect it, when it is detected, the White House sit room has 20 minutes to decide what to do. Now, if the launch had been detected at the time of launch, how much more time would there have been?
Oh, I'm thinking, you know, single digit minutes. It wouldn't have been a lot more time.
It wouldn't have been a lot.
Some more time, sure. Okay. As we used to say in the White House, every minute counts. So, you got to make that decision to get the word to the principals. Don't hesitate to get the word to them, even if you're wrong. You know, you want to get the information as quickly as possible to them. So,
what about other nations in the world and their detection systems? I mean, because you would think that somebody might have detected it and then told the United States about it, alerted the United States. There seemed to be no discussion of that. What's the reality here?
That's a valid point. And I honestly, I'm 10 years out of the intel business. So my recollection on what systems other nations may have with regards to IR detection. I'm sure some of the more advanced nations must have it, like Russia and China. So, you know, you raise a good question, but that gets back to why this is a movie, not a documentary. Right.
But on the bigger one,
yeah,
our ground-based mid-course defense system, which was created during the Bush years to defend against a North Korean missile attack.
Right.
And there's that line that the Secretary of Defense blurts out. You're saying it's a coin toss as to whether or not we can intercept this missile.
What
that
do you say,
was
$50 billion for this
moment in the film.
So Noah Oppenheim, who wrote the script, he's a former colleague of yours. We used to run NBC News. He did an impeccable amount of research on this. There was a recent book put out last year by Jacobson, I can't remember her first name, apologies, talks about this similar scenario in her book. They consulted with folks at Stratcom, people who were involved in the missile defense business on a day-to-day basis, and the statistics they cite in that movie, I think you have the Deputy National Security Advisor at one point saying, you know, it's a 61% kill ratio, is the honest-to-God truth. So, and the other thing they cite about the number of interceptors we have and how you can't just use them all at once, was also a legitimate concern. So it's
that was a legitimate concern because they didn't know if the first missile was just an opening salvo to draw in the U.S. to fire off all its interceptors.
Right, exactly.
and another huge, decapitation strike could be coming. They didn't know that. There's so many things they did not know. I have to ask you, did you ever, during your time as the White House Situation Room Senior Director, ever experience anything approaching this? Phantom ICBMs coming over the pole, anything like that?
So we never had any phantom ICBMs coming over the pole. We definitely had some missile launches. There were two pretty significant North Korean missile launches that took place during my time in the SIT room. In those cases, there was advanced intelligence about movements of, units and forces and preparations ahead of time. So we were prepared for a launch. And then when the launch occurred, those initial moments in assessing where the darn thing is going are a little bit, harrowing, and they talk about angles of inclination and suborbital and orbital flights. And in both cases that I was involved with, these were North Korean missiles that had a very, very high trajectory. And I think they both went over Japan, which is scary for the Japanese people for sure. But both landed well east of Japan in the ocean. So
can we just focus a little more on that 61%? Because to me, that's the biggest takeaway.
I'm not the expert, but sure, let's go.
Right. Okay. So what, the Secretary of Defense is discovering in the midst of a missile launch that our ability to intercept nuclear missiles is pretty porous. That's going to be startling to a lot of people. Should people be startled? Should they be alarmed? Are there steps we should be taking as a result of focusing on the inability of our missile defense system to intercept an attack of this kind?
Well, actually, I thought that I just want to underscore this question, because in a way, I think that that's the takeaway from the movie. That is the ultimate thing. And so I, just taking this a little bit further, it made me think about it within the context of the Iron Dome, the Golden Dome.
We'll get to that, but okay. I just want to hear Larry on the issue of what we're all agreeing is the biggest takeaway from this movie.
Well, the answer I was going to provide is it wouldn't surprise me if people who are proponents of Golden Dome would use this film as an opportunity to sell their program, for sure.
Yeah.
Should we be startled by this? Should we be doing
something? I think that's the purpose of the movie. I mean, that's what Catherine was trying to get people to recognize is, we are all of an age that, that we grew up with nuclear weapon threats being a concern. And some of us did drills hiding under desks in classrooms. And we had scary movies in the 80s when Reagan was president. And But since the end of the Cold War, since the wall fell, since we had, the START Treaty, and then we got super focused on the war on terror, we just haven't as a nation had a legitimate conversation about nuclear weapons. And it's at a time when more countries now have nuclear weapons. More countries are talking about getting nuclear weapons. And the countries that do have nuclear weapons, some of them aren't our closest friends or allies. Some of them have never, the Chinese have never engaged with us on any meaningful discussions about nuclear arms, doctrine, hotlines, any of that sort of thing. So I think Catherine saw a podcast or read some articles and it just triggered her. She said, we need to have this conversation as a country. And even a conversation about the decision-making process around a missile launch and how you respond. I'm going to tell you, just like it was demonstrated in the movie, I was there for 2 years and a month in the Situation Room. I was involved in plenty of exercises that involved nuclear threats or chemical biological threats to major cities in the United States. And we actively trained how we as a SIT room would respond and engage with all the other people on that. But the only cabinet level official or above that ever participated in any of those exercises was Ash Carter when he was Secretary of Defense. And anybody who knows Ash Carter, that was his wheelhouse. I mean, he was Mr. Proliferation and nuclear weapons and technology.
Was really surprising that in the movie there is sort of themes like so many people aren't home and aren't available. And who's actually participating in the conversation to decide how to assess the threat and how to respond to the threat? So that was something that you think reflects reality?
So it's interesting when we were working on the script, and I was reviewing the script and offering my comments and thoughts on it. One of my first comments was, hey, there's a part of the script where they call to put the national security advisor in the call. And the wife says, oh, sorry, he's getting a colonoscopy right now. And the Situation Room is surprised. Well, you know,
that's a good metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to tell you, we prided ourselves in the Situation Room of knowing the availability at any given moment of any key principal.
Yeah, but Larry, Lloyd Austin went into the hospital as Secretary of Defense, the White House didn't even know it.
I raised that concern. I said, look, my sit room guys are going to be a little upset that it looks like they don't know where their boss is. And, you know, can we modify that somehow? And they came and Noah Oppenheim looked at me and he said the exact thing. He went, Secretary Austin? And I went, ah, okay, good point. All right. I will follow my sword on that one.
I have to, you know, one of the startling things in the movie, there's so many startling things is, you know, people crack up. There are a couple of crack-ups, one of which just made me almost jump out of my chair.
Yeah. No spoiler alerts.
No. During your time at the White House Situation Room, first I should ask, what kind of psychological screening actually goes on to make sure people can handle this kind of stress? And two, did you ever experience during a practical exercise that some people said, I can't take this and I want out of here?
So I can speak to the Situation Room itself. So when we would interview people to come work in the Situation Room, these are people who are detailed from departments and agencies involved in intelligence and national security. They come on anywhere from a 1 to 2 year detailed. The people that are sent are the best of the best, best and brightest from their agencies and departments. But when we interview, when I would interview them, one of the things that I would discuss is, you know, you need to be able to juggle a lot of balls at one time. You need to be able to go from 0 to 100 miles an hour in a split second, which I think they demonstrate very well in this movie. And you need to maintain your composure. And if you aren't able to do that, we're gonna move you back home because we can't have that. And there were times in my tenure where there were individuals who suffered at what I would call stage fright almost when they would suddenly be on a phone call with the Secretary of Defense and have to connect them with the Vice President or the President. And they would crumble under that. Or if there was just even an emergency half as scary as the one depicted in this movie, some people just get emotional and, you know, we'd say like, hey, we can't have this. This is a job that doesn't have a long window of on the job training. You got to pretty much perform as soon as you get there. So we would move them on. Rebecca Ferguson, who does a masterful job playing the senior duty officer in the Situation Room, when she was meeting with me to discuss the character, you know, what drove them, how did they act, how did they respond, what was their emotional approach to the job, I said to her that one of the things we tell all of our senior duty officers when they're selected for the job is that their team is going to reflect their level of emotion. So if in a crisis you are starting to crumble or you are starting to get overly excited or you're starting to get angry, you need to find a way to bring that down. And I said, one of the ways, because we're all human beings. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the movie demonstrates that. You know, these are not automatons. These are human beings put in incredibly stressful circumstances. I said, what you as the leader of that team need to do is you need to step aside, even for just a split second or two, get yourself back under control and come back out and maintain a professional demeanor throughout. And she built that into the character, actually to Catherine Bigelow's surprise. When making the movie, she actually stepped out of the frame and went into a side room. Catherine's like, what are you doing? She says, well, Larry said, but they built that into the movie.
So just to cap that off, you can do all the interviewing and psychological testing in the world.
Yeah.
But you don't know how people are going to react until they're in the actual situation.
So in a couple of the screenings that I've been to where there were either current or former Situation Room people in the audience, one of the things when I would talk to him afterwards, you know, I'd say, hey, did I do all right? Is this good? You know, I felt like I captured it, but what'd you think? One of the responses I got was, oh, they were a little too emotional. And I'd look at him and I'd say, yeah, but I get what you're saying, but that was the absolute possible worst day you could ever have. And I'm not 100% sure everybody in that room would be able to maintain their composure completely. I said, I think the overall tone will be, yes, they will. They're gonna do their duty. They're going to stay there. They're going to be professional. A great example of that, and it was used in this movie, was the Situation Room on 9/11, when there was the threat that airplanes were coming to hit the White House. And the White House was evacuated, and Secret Service came in and told all the sit-room people, you got to get out of here. And the sit-room people looked at each other, what? And they said, we're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And then the guy said, okay, well, then I need you to write on this pad of paper. I need all your names and social security numbers, because if this place gets destroyed, we want to know who the heck was in here. And they all wrote their names and social security numbers down. And just an incredibly powerful demonstration of the sense of mission and duty and patriotism that the people who come to the Situation Room bring. Now, what I will say is the lessons of 9/11, there are definitely procedures in place that would make it much less likely that any of those people would have to, anybody working in the sit room would ever have to put their name on a list, because they're going to die. There are alternative locations that can be gotten to that can save their lives. But again, at the end of the day, there's no 100% guarantee that you'll move fast enough in the face of a threat.
One of the characters that's, I think, somewhat hard to understand in the movie, and sort of along the lines of what you were talking about before, is the president. Mm-hmm. The president, I'm just kind of wondering if you were privy to any conversations about a president who seems not to have a whole team around him that he's interacting with, to be somewhat confused about what to do, to be somewhat a deer in the headlights, as is understandable from the situation. But just, was there any, either in the screenings or in the making of the movie, any kind of discussion about why and how the president was portrayed this way?
Well, honestly, in that scenario, that conference video call that was established is the one that would be established. The people who are primary in that call are the people who have statutory authority with regard to the use of nuclear weapons and in retaliation. Now, one would have perhaps expected the vice president to be on the call. One might have expected Secretary of State, maybe a DNI or a DCIA would be in on the call. And we discussed that, but I think, again, that gets back to, you're making a movie, not a documentary, and for, you know, to make things flow a little more easily, you know, maybe given the time constraints, et cetera. But that was the dramatic movie decision they made. But I will tell you, there were times we sat on the Situation Room floor in a quiet moment, me and my deputy and all, and we would talk about, you know, the worst possible day, because I relied on the senior duty officer and the watch teams to kind of do the routine day to day, which could be a very slow day with not a lot going on, just putting summaries together. Or it could be a day like we had when I was there, like Benghazi, where we got a bit consumed with what was going on in Libya. But the senior director, which was the job I had, the job played by Jason Clarke in this movie, and my deputy, who has a very small role in the movie in this instance, the conversations we would have would be about continuity of government, continuity of the presidency. How do we ensure that the president is going to have a Situation Room like capability to support him or her on the very worst possible day? And we expended a lot of energy, a lot of thought, and a lot of money to do the very best job we could to ensure that the president would continue to get all that advice, and that nerve center would be up and running for him or her on a very, very bad day. Now, I will tell you, I think Idris Elba did a great job portraying the exhaustion a president often has. I mean, they're going, you know, sun up to well past sundown. They're doing the ludicrous thing, like, you know, going from shooting hoops with, you know, elementary school girls to, you know, suddenly having to make life and death decisions. That's a reality. I think we all have to be very careful when we elect a president who we elect.
I must say, it's inevitable, I think, for most people sitting in the theater. I turned to my companion and said, Can you imagine today's clowns handling a situation like this? Tulsi Gabbard, Pete Hegseth, et cetera.
Let's not forget Jeff Goldberg in on the Signal chat. But
it would have been a different movie.
yeah. But can I just say on that, look, in the movie at the end, the president is being handed this options for nuclear retaliation against presumably North Korea, full scale. But I have to say that struck me as a note that was off, because based on the information that the president has at the moment, you still don't know what is going on. Was this a one-off rogue operator in a submarine in the Pacific, or was it part of a full-scale North Korean attack, which doesn't seem to make much sense because they know they would be completely destroyed if
As the one character describes it, death by suicide, yeah.
Yeah. So how could the president have made a decision about retaliation at that point when there's no intel about what's actually behind all this?
Well, I think the movie leaves it very vague as to what the president actually will end up doing. I mean, I think that's part of the movie is to prompt that conversation, is what would a president do? Well, actually, I think the conversation is actually, why would we ever have one single human being being put into that kind of position? There's got to be a better way to do this. And I'm not even 100% sure he was given just an option to go after North Korea. It could have.
Yeah, he had.
Had the general at Stratcom saying, right, "Let's just go after everybody. The Russians, the Chinese, they must be behind this."
Strange.
Again, with no intel that they are. He's just, speculating. Well,
he was. If I recall, he was handed the book with the pages, the red pages, not the orange or the green or the yellow or whatever. It was in the major retaliation section. So, yeah.
I'm wondering if you had ever participated in discussions of real life options. For example, some nuclear strategists have raised the question that give one example. North Korea takes out Seoul or occupies Seoul in a lightning strike. The question is, would we trade and threatens it if we respond? They will take out Los Angeles. The question is, would we trade Los Angeles for Pyongyang? And that's a real life good question to be raised. Do you remember ever being in a conversation along those lines that we would actually be frozen by that kind of situation?
I mean, I personally was never in that kind of a conversation. That's a very, very high pay grade conversation to have.
I mean, Russia, let's say, takes out Lithuania or Estonia or Ukraine in the immediate instance.
Well, I think the General Brady character played by Tracy Letts in the movie says it very well at one point. He said, the absolute ludicrous notion that when I came into work this morning, that at some point today I'd be saying, yeah, let's give up a major American city. Just as absurd. But I would imagine that at the strategic doctrine level, at the highest levels of the Pentagon and at the highest levels of the principals and National Security Council, those kinds of conversations happen sometimes, but I will tell you, they don't happen a lot. They probably happen a lot at Stratcom, at Northcom, at the Pentagon. But having those conversations with the president and the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor, it's just not. They're very, very busy people, and it's not often considered the most likely thing that will ever happen.
Shit happens, as they say. Yeah. I want to swing back to this question that Mike raised about the Golden Dome. Mm-hmm. There's been a fair amount of discussion about this, and some critics point out, look, United States is not Israel. It's a much bigger place. Mm-hmm. A Golden Dome idea is fantasy. Is that one of the takeaways that Catherine Bigelow wanted from this movie, that there is a need for a more complete missile defense system?
I mean, I don't know if she would specifically say that was a very specific argument she was making. I think she was just making the broader argument that may be among a whole list of questions that you might want to discuss. Is our missile defense system adequate? Could it be improved? Or are there other more political diplomatic ways to try to ensure that you never have to worry that your missile defense system is not 100% foolproof. You know, and there are people out there who theorize and argue that having a 100% foolproof missile defense system is in itself very destabilizing, because you now make you now suddenly appear to be invulnerable to attack. There are countries out there who will now look at that and think, so you now believe you're invulnerable. That now makes it open season on us, because you can attack us at will.
That's what the Russians, The Russians were very upset about the ABM proposals by the Reagan administration.
Right. It can be a destabilizing issue in and of itself.
As I understand it, the Golden Dome that Trump has proposed or suggested, although there's no specific plan, as I understand it, but anyway, would be much bigger, costlier, trillions of dollars, not just to stop a stray North Korean missile, but all Chinese, all Russian, all Iranian, a much vaster, more complicated system than we've got now, and much more difficult. I mean, you know, the caption in the movie, you know, trying to stop a bullet with a bullet only multiplies when you're trying to prevent, you know, a full scale Soviet
machine gun,
a Russian attack. I should.
Well, you have to remember too that the systems we have in place right now are designed for things that are ballistic. You know, every significant country out there is developing hypersonic missiles that do not go ballistic.
Right. And even the Israelis with Iron Dome weren't able to stop every Iranian or even every Houthi missile fired at them. So that said, you know, help us. Where are you about missile defense? I mean, does it make sense after working on this movie that we should be investing more, or is it a chimera that we can never achieve protection?
That's a very, very big question to ask.
Yes, it is.
But I do say so.
But it's the question raised by this movie.
I mean, I mean, my personal Larry Pfeiffer's belief is that we could probably enhance and improve and build on the missile defense capabilities we have. I think largely to protect ourselves against the more rogue nations, the North Koreas, Pakistan, Indians of the world. And then I think we could spend a lot more time having strategic talks with countries like China and Russia, and with our NATO allies about limiting the number of nuclear warheads that are out there, putting curbs on some of the technological developments that destabilize the balance, having enhanced communications for crises. Like I said, we've got, you know, pretty robust, we have a robust ability to talk to the Russians on a really bad day. Although in this movie that didn't play out as well as it probably could have,
there was no hotline.
Well, they did reference that they were on the hotline. They said that with the vice foreign minister, they were on the hotline.
I would have thought it would be president to president rather than president Russia to foreign minister to the deputy security advisor.
What the movie doesn't explore is, you know, I mean, maybe Putin. If it was Putin, maybe he was indisposed in some capacity. Not reachable. It's hard to say.
But I got one quick follow up to what you just said. Does the need to talk to the Russians to maintain stability, to prevent this kind of scenario, does that factor into your own thinking when you think about how much we should be supporting the Ukrainians right now, given that every time we escalate with another system to give to the Russians, to give to the Ukrainians, the Russians immediately start talking about nuclear war?
Yeah, I fall into the camp, and you know, there are some who would argue that we're being dangerous, but I fall into the camp that the Russians are largely bluffing, and that they, better than any nation, understands the ramifications of using nuclear weapons in any theater of war. So I believe we should be helping the Ukrainians as much as possible, and more than we currently are. But that's a big debate. That's another big debate. But I think there's some who would argue that the Biden administration, particularly in its earlier days, worried more about what the Russians were threatening than they did as time progressed. And I think we're seeing the Trump administration, you know, trying to thread that needle as best they can as well.
Nevertheless, calling someone's nuclear bluff is a pretty dicey situation. could make any president's toes curl.
Well, and frankly, having a president of a country like Russia threatening the use of nuclear weapons, to me, just underscores the need for both countries to, you know, sit down and have meaningful conversations about the responsible management of this arsenal. As the president in this movie says at one point, he goes, wasn't the whole point of having what we have and being as prepared as we are, wasn't that all about preventing anybody from ever attacking us? So how did this ever happen?
What's the phrase, sacrifice or suicide?
Sacrifice or suicide, something like that. Yeah. Surrender or suicide.
Surrender or suicide, right. Surrender or suicide.
And there are lots of writers out there who do argue that our doctrine, as it's currently written, goes to suicide very, very quickly.
Yeah.
I dare say that Athens and Sparta and Persia had these internal debates as well over whether, you know, to negotiate with their foes as opposed to building more weapons, more ships, and whatever, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
And the lesson of history is really, I'm going to say that the lesson of history is that building more and better weapon systems do not ensure peace. Quite the opposite.
Another consultant on the film was a Lieutenant General Dan Warbler, I believe his name is. And at one of the screenings I was at, somebody asked him what he hopes comes out of this movie. And he said his number one hope is that it creates the conditions that where the U.S. and Russia will sit down and renegotiate the START treaties and improve and enhance on them. That was his number one takeaway from the movie.
I hope Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin see this movie, if they haven't stolen it already.
Well, they brought up a great point that if it was Korea, that, you know, that Korean national intel officer who's, you know, dancing between cannons and gunfire at the Gettysburg reenactment, you know, she says at one point to the president, she said, or to somebody, she said, the North Koreans may actually believe that their elite can survive a nuclear retaliation against their country, that they've got a bunker system that would allow them to sustain life for a period of time and survive. And I've heard that discussed as kind of a crazy theory. But yeah.
Well, on that happy note. We have to wrap it up. Larry Fiver, thanks for taking the time to discuss this. I urge everyone to see this movie. It is startling. It's gripping. It's good movie making, first of all. So it's very entertaining in its own macabre way. There's a lot of thinking going on in the movie lobby on the way out. I must say, everyone was pretty quiet.
Yes,
I saw it. So
anyway. It's a very sobering movie. And the only other point I would also make, particularly right now while we have a government shutdown heading into its third week here, you're going to see in this movie a portrayal of a lot of dedicated public servants in the military and civilian world who are putting their lives on the line, who are working hard at every moment to protect this country. And they are all the real people are all continuing to do that right now. And they're all doing it without any pay and with the unnecessary distraction that a government shutdown brings with it. And so I hope people who see this, who have the ability to make decisions, will realize the folly of what they're doing with the government shutdown and the treatment that they're providing to people who are, you know, your friends, your neighbors, your colleagues, they're the coaches of your kids' soccer team. They ride the bus with you. They walk the streets of Washington or the streets of Greeley, Alaska with you. And I think that's something I think Catherine does very well in her movies, is portray the people who do this work selflessly every day.
From your lips to Allah's ears, I hope this government shutdown ends soon. And it is a good reminder that the people who do this kind of work are not part of the deep state. They are ordinary folks like you and me. You may have met them on your city council or even in the Boy Scout, you know, leadership, that people have differences of opinions, but they don't attack each other as part of a sinister cabal out to destroy the others. So
right.
We'll leave it at that. Larry Pfeiffer, very valuable and an entertaining podcast today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't done so already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And so that's it for now. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isagoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
We'll see you next time.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.